This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking try free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The Slate Political Gabfest is sponsored by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. Casper mattresses come with free delivery and returns within a 100-day period. And right now, get $50 toward any mattress by visiting casper.com/political and using the promo code POLITICAL. And by Trunk Club. Answer a few simple questions about your look, style, and size, and receive a trunk full of great-looking clothes that fit perfectly and make you look amazing. Only pay for the clothes you keep, and shipping is free. Go to trunkclub.com/gabfest. And by stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer, and save up to 80% compared to a postage meter. Sign up for a no-risk trial and a $110 bonus offer when you visit stamps.com and use the promo code GABFEST.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political GABFEST for August 7th, 2015, the 9 German Shepherds and 1 Raccoon edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I'm in a lonely studio, not at our home studio. We're all scattered to the winds. John Dickerson of Face the Nation, where are you?
Well, I'm now back in D.C. after a very early morning flight from Cleveland this morning.
And Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine, where are you, Emily?
I'm in Maine, near New Hampshire, looking out on some nice trees from a little tiny room with a phone in it.
Oh, so jealous. On this week's GABFEST, the first Republican debate, more anticipated than, I don't know, a Jay-Z album, more DVR than a Game of Thrones finale. It was Thursday night in Cleveland. We delayed our taping a day just so we could absorb it and revel in it. Did it live up to its expectations? Who won it? We'll talk a lot about that. Then Washington is buzzing a little bit with the possibility that Joe Biden will make a late dive into the Democratic primary campaign. Is that a true possibility or just a scenic rumor? Then it's a year after Darren Wilson shot and killed Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. We'll talk about a new article about Wilson and whether a year of death and protest have changed America. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter, and in Slate Plus, how to stay current on the news while you're on vacation, as Emily Bazelon apparently is all the time.
I'm pretending to be current on the news, and I am no longer on vacation. I am working this second by talking to you.
Yeah, but then as soon as we're done, you're going to stop working.
Wrong, in fact, sadly. Oh. But anyway. No.
If you're not yet a Slate Plus member, you can get Slate Plus membership by going to slate.com/gabfestplus. And who wouldn't want to do that? Because we have a live show in San Francisco coming up on September 15th, to which you would get a buoyant, superb discount if you were a Slate Plus member. But even if you're not a Slate Plus member, September 15th at the Norris Theater, slate.com/politicalsf. We are doing a great big show. We've loved our San Francisco shows so far. We're really looking forward to this. So slate.com/politicalsf. It's at on September 15th. I don't know what day of the week that is. It's a day of the week. It is some day of the week. And we really hope you are there. Okay. That was that debate last night. That was amazing. That was the best 2 hours of television I've had this year. John, tell us about what it was like to be in the room. Were you in the room? Or were you just there?
No, you're never in the room. This is the silly. First of all, it's much more interesting what you guys think than what I do, because you have fresher eyes about it. But you're not in the room. You're in the room next to the room and separated by masses of black drapery. So you're nowhere. You cannot see the stadium hall in which the debate took place. So it's, you're in a room with, 450 other reporters, which had two other areas. One was the sort of Facebook lounge area. Facebook was co-hosting the debate, and then there was the spin room area, which I successfully stayed out of. But that's the bit where it's empty for the whole debate, and then just before the end, it's flooded with surrogates for the candidates who come in and talk about how fantastic the candidates were.
What was your sense overall of who performed better than expectations? Was there as much kind of enthusiasm as there was in my living room, where we thought
it was
so exciting?
Yeah, it was a great show. It was a great show for a lot of different reasons. From the minute it started, the Fox News questioners were great. Their questions were wonderful. And the first one was perfect, because, we all laugh at the raise your hand gimmick, but they used it in a genius way to say, if any of you on stage would not support the ultimate Republican nominee and would not say that you will not run as an independent, raise your hand. Now, I've said it with all those horrible double negatives, so you're probably confused by now, but they did it in a much more elegant way because they probably had more sleep. But anyway, that this Donald Trump raised his hand and said, he can't say he wouldn't support. I mean, he can't say he would support the ultimate nominee if it weren't him. He said if he were the nominee, he would support himself. And he said
that
he would not
really
pledge.
That was really the best line of the night. If I'm the nominee, I will not run as an independent.
Right. And then he would not pledge. He would not pledge to not run as an independent. And this received like boos. It got Rand Paul went after him for it. And what was great was that then Trump, in defending himself, he said we have a lot of leverage. And it was great because there was like the deal maker in him coming out immediately. He has leverage over the party, and because a lot of Republicans think if he runs as an independent, he'll steal votes from them and give the election to the Democratic nominee if it's Hillary Clinton. And so from the word go, it was just a rollicking, rattling cart trip down the track. And we can talk about all the rest, but I want to hear what you guys think before I give you my larger assessment.
I mean, I thought it was incredibly refreshing to have someone on the stage in the person of Donald Trump, for whom there is sort of nothing at stake. He's not playing by the normal rules. He doesn't sound like a politician. He makes almost no point does he descend into the cliches about how America can be strong again, which are just so tempting and pulled in the other candidates way too often. And so it's like you have your cranky
wow.
old...
Look, go finish your thought, then I'll.
Well, I just feel like it's like having your cranky uncle calling bullshit on everyone else, and it's not like what he's saying makes a whole lot of sense or is consistent, but it doesn't matter because he sounds like he's cutting through all these layers of pleasant pablum and tedium.
But,
and
Emily,
I don't mean to say that all the other candidates were just pleasant and tedious because there were other interesting moments, but I felt like it. Because he is setting this different tone, it forces at least some of the time other people to sound more interesting too.
I just think that that gives him so much more credit than he deserves. Half of his answers literally make no sense. You listen to it and you think, I have no idea what the A to the C there is. Like, I don't, there's no path.
Totally. Yeah,
that
there
takes
were lots
you logically.
Of undiagrammable sentences, but
it's
did
not
you
even,
feel
but
like
it's not
he
that they're
was
undiagrammable
along anyway? And you
it's
were like.
It's not undiagrammable sentences, it's that it's an undiagrammable thought. It is
well,
not,
yes,
there's not
I
a coherent thought.
Completely. But I'd still rather watch that than have people saying, you know, and America can be strong again. I literally, if I could have wiped all the cliches out of the debate, I would have been so much happier than wiping Donald Trump out of the debate, nonsensical as he was.
I really think that gives him way more credit than he deserves. And
so why were you riveted for 2 hours?
Oh, it's not that why was I riveted for 2 hours? One, he is you just watched it. I use this for the title of the show. It was like watching nine dogs debating a raccoon, that you just had no idea what was going to happen because he was a different species. And so that was that drama was exciting. But he himself provided. I was surprised. I thought he would have more substance. I thought he'd actually say something that was more persuasive than he did. That's number one. And number two, I actually thought the others were thrilling and that there was a lot of drama going on and seeing
so
them all in the wild
who,
for the first
in particular,
time.
Which moments, which candidates stood out to you?
Well, for me, go ahead, John. You go ahead.
I would just interject that we have no idea. There have been a bunch of different times where Trump has behaved in a way that people have said, that's it. Like, it'll never work. This isn't, you know, people are going to get turned off or the act is going to wear thin or you can't insult POWs in general and John McCain in specific. And he's not only survived, he's done better. That isn't to say that will be the result here. I think it's to just remind us that we don't know what the weather's like in planet Trump. And I think that so that a lot of what you say, David, it could be true and could nevertheless not matter to the support he has. I think where it still does matter and where I think what we got was, despite Trump's rise within the Republican Party, it has always been true. And there, you know, to the extent that he boasts about himself being up in the polls, those same polls have consistently shown two things. One, when you ask Republicans, who is the Republican you won't vote for? Trump is at the top of that list. And then secondarily, when you run him in the general election context among registered voters, which more closely approximates the general election, or the head-to-heads with Democratic opponents, Sanders, Biden, and Clinton, he gets trounced. So for primary voters who are ultimately going to care about who can win in the general, that's like a huge problem. He did nothing to help that problem when he responded to the question about women and his harsh treatment of some of them, or his verbal abuse and the mean names he called them. His response was to say, I'm sick of political correctness, which I think encapsulates the whole Trump both appeal and problem, which is the appeal is there are a lot of conservatives who think, you know, exactly, I'm sick of like not being able to say things the way I want to say them. And I'm sick of everybody mincing around issues because they're worried about being called a racist or sexist or whatever. So he taps into that. On the other hand, if you're, you know, the women's vote is not unimportant in politics, and kind of his little criticism of Megyn Kelly wrapped into his answer shows that, you know, he's not going to be he's not making inroads in the swing voting women's population, and that would be important in a general election. So I think we got to wait like a week.
Absolutely. I mean, rationally speaking, the man is not going to be president, and he's going to hit his ceiling soon. But I bet his numbers go up after last night, not because he was making a lot of sense. But because if you are disaffected and you're a Republican voter, he just seems so much more forceful and compelling than, to me, than the candidates who were in that category who were on that stage last night. I mean, and I'm thinking now of Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Mike Huckabee, Ben Carson, who I didn't like. He just, if you're a protest voter and you're a conservative, I just feel like he is still gaining momentum. And of course it's going to fall apart because he's not obeying the laws of normal politics. At some point that's going to catch up with him, but I don't think yet.
I think John's point, original point, is the key one to hold to, though, Emily, which is that we have no idea the behavior of Trump voters is so erratic that we just really have no idea. Like, his numbers could go up, they could crater, any number of things could happen.
But I don't think they've been that erratic. They've been growing. They've been well, who knows who is answering the polls, but it seems to me like he's erratic. And yes, like, maybe he could turn everyone off eventually by just doing something that's over the top. But he seems like he is just speaking his mind. And if stylistically that is important to you, then, and also it's not boring, right? I mean, I still, David, want to hear like what you thought were the really compelling moments from other candidates, because other candidates obviously were trying to offer some substance.
So for me, the ones who were sort of shockingly bad, I thought Jeb Bush was shockingly bad. I thought Scott Walker was just poor. But I thought, I mean, obviously as a Democrat, John Kasich was warm and compassionate and compelling. I have no idea whether that has any valence in the Republican primary electorate, but I thought he was superb. Marco Rubio felt wonderful. I mean, he exudes this air of, I mean, just happiness, of normality, of reasonableness, of kind of calmness, of good temperament. And the things he said seemed, they more or less made sense. And so to me, those two were the ones I thought came out of it looking great, along with Carly Fiorina from the earlier one. And then if I were a red meat voter, I would have thought Ted Cruz was feeding me something delicious. I found him absolutely terrifying in a way that really surprised me. He was the one I came away thinking, like, this would be, if America had this man as president, there would be something truly dire happening. And goodness gracious, I hope it doesn't happen. And the others were kind of non-entities, Huckabee and Carson.
Why did you think George Bush came off so badly, David? I mean, not George Bush.
I might call him Jeb Bush. Maybe that was part of it.
He looked so much like his dad last night. So maybe that's my excuse for that mistake. Jeb Bush, the former governor of Florida.
I saw someone tweet this today. I can't remember who it was, saying something like, if you'd come from Mars and you didn't know that Jeb Bush had raised all the money and was the front runner, you would never come away from that debate thinking he was anything. That he had none of the authority that, say, a Mitt Romney had at this stage in 2012. He seemed really to fade. He didn't have a forceful presence. He didn't have smart things to say. He didn't say anything terrible. He just felt like a non-presence. What did you guys? So that was me. So John, what was your who did you think?
Who grabbed you?
So I kind of felt like nobody had, if Republicans were looking for a sorting mechanism, and is hoping that this debate would do it, I don't think they got it. I mean, they got it in one sense, which is that it was sorted into two different debates, and there was a top 10, and then there were the remaining seven. But even there, Carly Fiorina seems to have done well enough in the first debate, according to all kinds of different metrics, to kind of now be, leaping over into the first batch. So you now have, and so I felt like of the 10 on the adult table or the primary debate, nobody did, there was no great gaffe. There was no disqualifying gaffe. And so if you were a Jeb Bush supporter, you would think, he said what he explained his position on Common Core. He explained why Donald Trump was offering the wrong tone for the party, and those were his two strongest answers, I felt. And because you're going to see in the guys what you want to see in them because you like them. But I think more of the objective viewer, I think David's right about I felt anyway about Bush and Walker that they did fine. They said what they were, but they didn't make anybody talk about them the next morning. Nobody's like,
agree.
Wow, those two. So those, and I felt that was roughly the same. Huckabee's answer, he gave a passionate answer about Iran, I think. So he would have his supporters who love him anyway. He didn't do anything to discourage them. And his defense on Iran maybe is something people would say. Yeah, he explained why I don't like the Iran deal. Carson was played the outsider and was sort of warm, and people like in the conservative movement, they just like the, you know, his answer on race, for example, when he talked about, you know, when I go in and do a surgery, I operate on the part that defines you, which is the brain. It's not the skin. And that's a way of talking about race that's appealing, and particularly appealing to conservatives. So I think there were things that, but I would put those two sort of in the category above Bush and Walker. I thought Christie and Paul had a great exchange about Paul.
The Fourth Amendment.
Paul standing up for the Fourth Amendment, arguing that the government had overreached with the Patriot Act, and Christie doing what was a familiar riff for him, but arguing that he'd used the Patriot Act when he was a federal prosecutor, and then he understood, you know, because of his experience on 9/11, that these tools were important and powerful. It was an exchange that was quite heated, that probably served both of them well. I would argue that Rand Paul has the Fourth Amendment crowd already in his pocket. Christie, on the other hand, has to do something to grow his stature. He he was at like the ninth spot of the 10 getting in. And now he's given he was in a moment where he showed, you know, I'm strong on national security and I'm not going to let these terrorists get away with it. And I think he also had a back and forth with Huckabee on entitlements and another answer on defense where he was clearly, you know, those policy speeches he's been giving paid off, and he felt in command of his brief. So I think because he's got more voters who care about national security in the same way he does, probably had got the better of that exchange just in terms of being able to milk it for additional support. The Kasich, I agree. I thought Rubio is the one that interests me because he gave some strong answers. His argument, you know, how's Hillary Clinton going to lecture me about people living paycheck to paycheck? I grew up in a family living paycheck to paycheck. He also, I thought, gave a great answer about in the immigration question, which is a bit of a landmine for him because he worked with Democrats on a comprehensive immigration plan. He said, you know, what about the people who call my office, who've been standing in line, who are going through the irritating and confusing process? And
that was great.
That was, I felt, the real, that was real art. People talk about how he's such an artful politician, and I'm always never able to quite get there with them because his statement about how's Hillary Clinton going to lecture me, it's fine, well executed, but like totally familiar. But what he did on the immigration issue was he brought emotion and he just grabbed that issue, which again is one that's not great for him, and really like said, like he just dropped it and said, this is what's real. Like, so I thought that was pretty talented, but I still like have this hurdle I can't get over, which is, are the Republicans really going to nominate a one-term senator with no executive experience? Like at the end of the day, I know people vote with their guts, not their head, and I'm making a sort of head argument, but I just don't see how they get there. And if they do, it will be because Rubio did exactly what Obama did, which David Axelrod writes about in his book, which is use the campaign and moments like this in the campaign to create the illusion of leadership. In other words, you haven't done it in your private life or as a governor or, you know, or even you could argue that Ben Carson running these surgical teams was a leader of sorts. So you haven't done it. You don't have that experience as a leader with a person with executive experience in private life, but because you perform well, voters in sort of convey it upon you because they say, oh, he was commanding. And so you're literally doing it through the power of your rhetoric, which is what drives conservatives so crazy about Obama, that he's just a good talker. So if Rubio rises, it will be by using the exact same road.
Emily, what about what's your diagnosis of the 10?
I agree with most of what's been said. The people who surprised me the most were Kasich, who I thought just seemed smart and relaxed and pretty personable. I didn't agree with everything he said. I thought his answer about Trump, you know, oh, he's touching a nerve, was pretty pandering and kind of a turnoff. But I generally felt like I would expect his numbers to go up. And I also thought Rubio was good. And I was surprised. I actually thought Walker was bad. Like, I had the same amount of negative reaction to Walker that you had to Bush, David. And he reminded me of Rick Santorum. There was something like a little cloying about him. And I also thought the Fox questioners did a great job of asking questions that exploited various weaknesses. And it's a little tough on Walker since he is a governor and has an executive record. They can say things to him like, hey, you promised 250,000 jobs for Wisconsin and only half of them materialized. There are these very specific weaknesses he has. And, you know, he had answers. It wasn't like he blew it in any big way, but he seems surprisingly sort of like soft to me. And he's someone I thought was going to seem much like come across in bold, vivid colors. And instead, he felt like he was sort of fading.
Yeah. So going to, as we go forward, I mean, I guess the folly of us making predictions, except for John, because he tends to make predictions based
actually
on data. But the folly of
yes.
You and me making predictions, Emily,
is, but we're the ones who
well
like
known.
To make them because we know nothing and nothing is at stake for us.
But it feels to me like, after this debate, Carson Huckabee and basically all of the JV7 except for Fiorina and maybe Perry are done, and that Fiorina gets elevated. Fiorina gets to play on the varsity now. Is that your sense of it, John? And that we now have a slightly different lineup. Or is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, right. So my initial comment is wrong in the sense that there has been some sorting. We're now down to maybe 11, where we were up, where we had 17 before.
That's not much of a sort.
Well, that's right.
From
I mean, that's
one debate,
why. That,
I don't know. That's pretty good. One
yeah,
debate.
Yeah, no, I mean, so I'm going to stand on the idea that it's both things can be true. And I think that's generally where things stand, because I think what I think has happened is for the remaining candidates, so for candidates 12 through 17, they need either a moment or they need the clouds to clear so that they can create their own moment. Well, there's not another debate until for another month, so that's a problem. And when they get to the other debate, they're going to be on the B card again. And until that time, you've got Trump creating clouds. You've now got other candidates who did well enough in this debate that people are going to be paying more attention. So you've got, you know, on the Sunday shows and the morning shows, it's now Kasich and Rubio. Plus, Walker and Bush will always be around because they've got a lot of money and people still like them. So there's a lot more, there are a lot more candidates who are now elevated by their performance and are going to get much, so it's that much harder to break through. You got to break through Trump and now Kasich, Rubio, and Walker and Bush, and maybe now Christie too. So I think that's going to be really, really, really hard. And I think
you
even
really think Christie did himself enough favors? I felt like he was going to go away too. I guess at least had some bold, you know, pugilistic moments.
I think he helped himself because Christie has skill. And that he showed, I think, in that back and forth with Rand Paul. Mm-hmm. He didn't shrink on that stage the way David described. He didn't fade the way David described Bush as fading. And Christie's kind of been fading since Bridgegate. I mean, he was the like guy that they were trying to get to replace Mitt Romney. He's the one that Mitt Romney said would be the nominee in this cycle. So, and I saw him when I was up in New Hampshire earlier this week. At a town hall, which was I hadn't seen him for 2 months in a town hall, and he's much, much better. So I guess the point is he's still a long shot, but you can see he's getting better and in his campaign, whereas you could argue, you know, Walker maybe kind of plateaued, Bush plateaued. You want to be a candidate that's getting better, and I think he is getting better. Now, whether this actually amounts to anything in the polls, we'll just have to see.
Can I just say I found his with the exchange with Paul and his wrapping himself in the 9/11 hugs and his smugness about that, just morally repellent in every way. I thought it was disgusting the way he did that. It was exploitative of the 9/11 victims. It's like it's a kind of play that is gross. And
yeah, I was in a room with a bunch of people watching, and at that moment there was a lot of like just sort of cringing going on.
I know it was, you know, it came across, I think it probably came across rhetorically as very effective, but it was gross enough when Giuliani did it, and he had at least had been mayor of New York and was, you know, mayor of the city, which was the attack, and we were closer to those attacks at the time. But to do that 15 years later in that way, I thought was
yeah,
vile.
It was smarmy. That's why I thought I wasn't sure that he was going anywhere.
Yeah, well, it'd be interesting to see if that's the way conservatives would see it. I mean, it's not impossible that we don't know. I would, you know, it's conservatives are obviously a far different audience.
Okay, last question, because we have to get to next topics, is for you, John. Do you think because Bush and Walker generally were perceived to at the very best to have been okay, and at the very worst to have really been out of the picture, do you think we will see any dramatic histrionics behavior from either of them over the next month to make it clear, like, oh, we really matter?
I don't know. I think Walker is a pretty, this is a puzzle that I haven't quite figured out yet. He is not a risk averse governor, right? Obviously he took big risks as a governor, but as a campaigner, he's pretty darn risk averse. And his answers were very, they were short. They were just basically edits of portions of his stump speech. And so you can see them, they're running some ads. They're putting out. They're doing some of the stuff you do to kind of say to at least the press, "Hey, look at me. You know, I'm Scott Walker." But I don't really expect a lot of histrionics unless like the polls just like massively show some kind of shift. One thing that interested me about Bush and that I wrote, and it may even be true, is that on when he gave his answer when he was asked about how he had criticized Donald Trump about the tone, and he said, yeah, I talked about his tone because I want to win. You could feel for a moment that the answer was more passionate in its delivery because
yes,
Trump
and then
had
he went
goaded
back to like America being strong again. And I was like, oh no, can you please stick with like, I want to win. It's important for the party to win. That sounded like an actual thought in your brain.
Yeah. And so I felt like Trump had pushed, I felt like Trump had pushed all of them in one way or another into being more forceful, more pointed, more, you know, the way we want candidates to be is be loud and proud about who you are and what you want. And Bush's argument is basically, you know, I know how to win in the general election. We need to keep focused on that because we're going to ruin our party by fighting the same old battles in the primaries. He may be wrong, but that's his theory. And he needs to be able to forcefully articulate it in a combat environment. And Trump created a combat environment, and so there was a moment there where I felt like Bush was a little bit more energized. That may not get, you know, people may not carry that on, you know, they may not be talking about that today, but if that's true and he was so inspired, then you could imagine him saying, because everybody talks about how competitive he is, you could imagine that sort of giving him the spur to be a little bit more kind of, you know,
real,
a little more blood in the face, yeah, mm-hmm. than we've seen. So
that was the point I was trying to make about Trump way back in the beginning of the discussion. You just said it much better.
The GabFest this week is brought to you by Casper. Casper brings you an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. They offer free delivery and returns, and they have mattresses that have just the right sink and just the right bounce, using two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, which come together for better nights and brighter days. There's a risk-free trial and return policy. You can sleep on the Casper for 100 days. That is a long time, 100 days. And then get free delivery and painless returns. Casper mattress has come to you. You're right to your door in a box. It's very nice. It doesn't, so you don't have to like schlep to the showroom. The mattresses are made in America and they are really well priced. It's $500 for a twin size mattress and $950 for a king size mattress. If you compare that to what you might pay in a showroom or from some of their competitors. That is an outstanding price. And there is, of course, a special offer for GabFest listeners. You can get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/GabFest using our promo code GABFEST. Terms and conditions apply. That's casper.com/GABFEST. Is Joe Biden running for president? That is a question that Democrats are asking themselves after a strange Maureen Dowd column in the New York Times last week in which she described Beau Biden, Joe Biden's son, on his deathbed, urging his father to make a run. The Biden speculation has been flourishing because of perceived problems in Hillary Clinton's campaign, which clearly has not caught fire yet. And there are scandals dogging it around Benghazi and her email server. Biden allies have implied that he's going to make a decision about whether to run during upcoming vacation. So is this real speculation, Emily?
I don't think so. I there seems to me something a little bit sad about this. I mean, look, it's the death of Beau Biden, Joe Biden's son, is tragic, and he has a lot of sympathy right now. And so I believed the piece that ran in the New York Times in which various anonymous confidants and advisors of Joe Biden said, you know, we really can't figure out how to tell him that he should not run. He could do a lot of damage to his own legacy. He's too gaffe prone. The party needs to get behind Hillary Clinton. And yet I could also feel some sense of like why he would have this lingering ambition and have trouble letting it go. But I think he is going to let it go because there's something just too selfish and irrational about it.
John, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that it's an interesting media story here because this was the question is why this boomlet. Part of it is perceived weakness about Hillary Clinton. I think, you know, Hillary Clinton's weakness is she's doing fine in the Democratic Party. She's doing really fine. Democrats like her. There's some people when you ask them, you know, Clinton or Sanders, they pick Sanders, but unlike with Donald Trump, they say, well, okay, but if you may be picking Sanders today, but if Clinton's the nominee, would you vote for her? And they say, oh yeah, sure, of course. That's not true with a lot of Republican voters about Trump. But Maureen Dowd wrote a piece in which she told the story of Beau Biden when he was dying, saying to his father, you've got to run. And so that kicked up a new set of conversations. But my reporting, both before this episode and then afterwards, is basically this is what was happening. People who don't like Hillary Clinton or people who think she's messing things up and will only continue to, or who have apocalyptic views about how this server thing is all going to turn out, have gone to Biden and said you should run, and that basically the office has been saying, well, thanks, and Biden has been kicking the idea around, but has been largely passive in the whole process. What's also true is that he knows, based on the people who have talked to him about it, that like this is a really hard thing to do. And why is it hard? Well, A, because Hillary Clinton is still very popular among Democrats, and those are the people you'd have to run against. B, she's got an organization that's well underway and lots of effort going towards building the kind of organization you need to run a nominating fight. The next point is she's raised a great deal of money, which he might be able to match. I don't think so. He doesn't really like raising money, but it takes a lot of time. He would have to start from scratch and build a crackerjack ground and money organization while launching a campaign and not, you know, providing gaps and being flawless on the stump. So, and there's not like a huge, there is a draft Biden operation out there, but it's not like the draft Warren operation. There is not an ideological yearning for Joe Biden. Disappointment with Hillary Clinton is not the same as love for Joe Biden. I mean, he's not ideologically different than Clinton. He's not generationally different. He's obviously of a different gender, but most Democrats think that would actually hurt their case because they think that being a woman will help Hillary Clinton in the general election. And the final point is he knows how brutal this would be. How, you know, imagine it gets into the stage we know it would get into. And so then suddenly Joe Biden has to like be talking about Hillary Clinton's server and how Americans can't trust her, so that it gets into a huge dogfight, and that would be a kind of an unpleasant result from where he stands now, which is as this kind of wise man of the party, who everybody has wonderful feelings about.
Is there So assuming a worst case scenario for Hillary Clinton, that the campaign is ongoing and then she either either misperforms in the campaign or misperforms in the campaign and the email server just gets worse and worse and worse. The party could find a way to pull Biden in as the candidate. It's pretty late on, right? Assuming that no one else has gathered up those delegates. Can't he be a fallback candidate without actually having to put a campaign together now?
In a sort of shooting the moon kind of way, maybe.
Fell apart and had a crack up and there was an emergency.
Also, I don't know the state of where pledged and unpledged delegates are. I've forgotten all of that information that we all knew by heart back in 2008. But by the time you get to the convention, she will have won probably enough pledged, unpledged, and superdelegates. By the way, the Democratic Party suddenly leaving and going to a new candidate at the last minute would be a kind of catastrophic admission of fail, you know, would be seen by people as a catastrophic admission of failure, and therefore delegates pledged to Clinton would be kind of nervous about doing that.
Yeah. I don't like the sentiment in that other New York Times story that, oh, Biden would tarnish his legacy. I mean, like, screw that. Running for president, if you think you're the right person to be president, you want to make a run, I think that's nonsense. I mean, I don't think you should run. There are all sorts of kind of good reasons not to run for president, but the, oh, you're going to tarnish your legacy argument seems to me highly wrongheaded and condescending. Let him.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with the way that argument was framed either. But when you think of it as like, what's the choice? It's doing all this hard, low odds, thankless, grubby fundraising and organizing work that John just described. Or it's, you know, you were a really good vice president. You have served the Democratic Party really well. You get to have some kind of other kingmaker, wise man role in the party. It just seems like the second option is so much more attractive.
It's definitely more attractive, but let's say it's in his heart that he wants to be president and he's not willing to, you know, kill Obama to do it. So why is it so why would it be? I mean, he's a politician. Why would you begrudge a politician who spent his life running for office, being on the political stage, taking that one last shot? And he wouldn't win, but it wouldn't be tarnishing. It would be, you know, the grand old lion makes his exit. It would be great.
I guess so, except if it's all just about you and it's not about ideological difference or really any attribute you have to offer that makes you more attractive, like, then it just seems, you know, kind of deluded and self-centered.
All right, let's hear from our next sponsor. Which is Trunk Club. Summer's here. You are too busy cooking on the grill, sunning on the sand, looking at a forest in Maine, hosting Face the Nation, to even think about setting foot in a mall. The problem is you still need to look fresh. Trunk Club gets it. That's why they've taken the hassle out of shopping by shipping you a trunk of clothes that fit perfectly and make you look like $1 million. At trunkclub.com/gabfest, you answer simple questions about your style, preferences, and size, and are then assigned an expert stylist who handpicks clothes curated from the best premium brands that are perfect for you. You pick what you like, and just like that, a trunk full of handpicked clothes arrives at your door. You only pay for the clothes you keep. No ongoing subscription, no hidden charges, just great clothes. And right now, their service is completely free. Get started at trunkclub.com/gabfest. That's trunkclub.com/gabfest. Have a great summer with Trunk Club. Trunkclub.com/gabfest. It was 1 year ago that Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson shot and killed Michael Brown on the street of that city. Wilson was not charged with any crime in Brown's death, as a grand jury decided that he had at least some reason to fear from Brown. But a Justice Department study found grotesque racism in Ferguson policing, notably in the endless harassing and ticketing and warranting of black residents largely as a way to raise funds for the city. Brown's death also sparked weeks of protests in Ferguson, and the year since has seen growing horror at the death of unarmed African Americans at the hands of police, from Walter Scott to Eric Garner to Tamir Rice to Freddie Gray. This has been the year of Black Lives Matter, but also of more deaths, even as we see the activism against it. There's a profile of Wilson in the New Yorker. Emily, what did you learn from that profile?
To me, the most interesting part of the profile was listening to Wilson try to grapple with race and seeing him as a prism for, you know, white police officers, and also I think for conservatives who are trying to think about what they can safely object to about black urban neighborhoods. So, you know, he doesn't want to be the lightning rod for the conservative movement. He's trying really hard not to use overtly racist language. And yet he's saying things like, you know, they have a different culture there, or, you know, race doesn't matter at all in police community relations, even though obviously he was struggling with just like knowing how to talk to black people as a cop. So I felt like there was something both, I didn't sympathize very much with him reading thousands of words about him, but I also felt like it was sort of useful to try to understand what the frustration that I think white conservatives like him have with the discussion we're having about race that's prompted by Black Lives Matter. You know, it's been such a summer of thinking about the role of history and sociology in the construction of urban neighborhoods, and, you know, how much are we still having this whole history that informs problems of poverty that are linked to race, that are predominate among black people. You know, Ta-Nehisi's book and the conversation about the Confederate flag has been so prominent. And yet there's also a backlash against that. But I feel like it's this sort of skulking, resentful backlash in which white conservatives are trying to figure out how to object to this and say, hey, what about personal responsibility without sounding like racists?
Do you think, John, that the Black Lives Matter activism, that all these terrible events, that the Confederate flag discussion, do you think they have actually changed American politics in a meaningful way? Do you think that race is an important part of the conversation that politicians at a national level are going to be having, or not really, because basically it's a Democratic issue because Republicans don't get black votes, and that they aren't part of it, and therefore it really isn't something that nationally we're grappling with?
I think we nationally grapple with it when these moments burst into the news and everybody has to grapple. So tragically, it's got to keep coming up in these flashpoint moments. I think, as you quite rightly pointed out, there are some Republicans, Rand Paul and Jeb Bush are the main ones who, and Mike Huckabee has been spending a lot of time in African-American churches, who talk about improving the relationship between Republicans and African-Americans. And, you know, Ben Carson doesn't talk about that so much, but he obviously is a part of the race conversation on the Republican side. But I don't think, and we haven't, you know, Rand Paul has given some speeches and gone to some places, but that isn't going to do it. I mean, we all know what it looks like when a candidate really throws his back into reaching out to a community, and particularly a community that's skeptical about that candidate or his party, requires a really sustained effort. And it's just in terms of the time candidates have and where it's most usefully spent, I just don't expect to see a lot of it on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, it will happen. Hillary Clinton, her coalition to win relies on African Americans, and so she really wants, and particularly if you buy the idea that African Americans in a place like Georgia could change the shape of that state, then you've got a real incentive for her to pay very close attention to what the African American community thinks about and cares about. But then you have to, and I'm way out of my depth here, figure out whether the specifics of the Black Lives Matter conversation, how that exactly affects the African American vote, and I don't know what the, you know, what the answer is to that. I mean, obviously,
and what are the reforms you get behind? I mean, the Black Lives Matter movement, obviously, you know, they want police to stop killing unarmed black people. Certainly a reasonable request. But then how do we get there? What's the most important? Is it training police in implicit bias? Is it making sure we have more African Americans on the police force, which is still not the case in Ferguson and a lot of communities like Ferguson? There are all these questions, and they are so local in the end. You know, we've learned a lot, if you've read about Ferguson, about the suburbs that are in a ring around St. Louis and how segregated they are and what their history is. And then if you multiply that by all the places in the country, small and large, it just starts to feel like you need some really intensive efforts from place to place to transform each one, and just so much effort and work going into that. And
the most depressing story I read in that vein this week, Emily, I don't know if you saw this, I think it was a CNN report where they looked at kind of the ticketing and warranting that was going on in Ferguson. Mm-hmm. And so one of the complaints about Ferguson, a lot of these small, heavily African-American jurisdictions with white police forces, is that there's a lot of use of just the kind of trivialities of the law to raise money from citizens. And so you give people lots of tickets, you, if they don't show up at their court date, you, there's an arrest warrant out. It just becomes this form of endless either paying up or harassment, which sometimes you end up in jail because of it. And that in Ferguson, there was this Justice Department report savaging Ferguson for doing this, and you saw a brief drop in the number of warrants that they were issuing, but it's all just jumped right back up. So in fact, in Ferguson, the very thing that they were doing, which was really the instigating force for why so many black citizens had antagonistic relationships with the cops, the cops are continuing to do, because I'm sure there are financial pressures on them, or that's just the way they were trained in policing. So that's a thing which it's not visible in the way that body cameras are visible. But it's a day-to-day form of oppression that's a real problem.
The other thing I listened to this week on This American Life, my colleague at the Times Magazine, Nicole Hannah-Jones, had a, to me, really powerful story about a sort of accidental integration effort that was also around St. Louis. There's a mostly black town called Normandy, and their schools were failing, and so 1,000 black kids got bused into a white suburb. And some of it actually, like, went well, and it's a very pro-integration piece. But the tape of the white parents in this suburb, their initial reaction before the black students actually arrived, the idea that they're going to be, oh my, didn't you find that so painful and horrifying to listen to? Oh, it was awful.
It's true that the really big solutions, which have always, in my view, always come back to things around school integration and jobs. No one's really talking about that. We haven't gotten to the William Julius Wilson dignity of work, opportunity of work parts of this. It's really been focusing a lot on sort of cop behavior and training cops, but so much of what
is actually
and especially as one of the nice things that's happening in this country, which does seem to be happening on the right, is the conversation about sentencing reform and prison reform, and just getting people out of the criminal justice system more quickly and with serving less time. That's a really good conversation, but it also means that you're going to have all these people who we've shipped off to be just to be warehoused in prisons, who are now going to be living in communities, who need things to do, who need meaningful work, and who need meaningful opportunity for education. And it's there doesn't seem to be any grappling with that at all from anybody.
Yeah. And all the racism that informs the discussion affects people's employment opportunities as well.
Yeah. All right. We have one more sponsor this week before Cocktail Chatter. We're sponsored this week by Stamps.com. Getting your mailing and shipping done can seem like a no-win situation. Going to the post office takes up valuable time. Leasing a postage meter is expensive and has multi-year commitments and hidden fees. But there's a better way, which is Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package right from your desk using your own computer and printer. You can even get special postage discounts you can't find at the post office. And Stamps.com, it's more powerful than a postage meter and a fraction of the cost. You can save up to 80% compared to a postage meter and avoid all those time-consuming trips to the post office. We have, of course, our special offer using our promo code GABFEST for a no-risk trial and a $110 bonus offer, which includes a digital scale and up to $55 in free postage. For all the details of the special offer and to sign up today, go to stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in GabFest. That's stamps.com. Enter GabFest. So, John Dickerson, in the post-debate bar scene, what were you chattering about? Or what would you have chattered about?
There we go. Had I
been able to get a word in edgewise?
Yeah. I am chattering about it. Unfortunately, it's a visual chatter, which for which I apologize. But every day for the last 5 years, a Japanese artist named Tetsuya Tanaka, I believe is the way you pronounce it, has done a daily picture of these tiny, tiny, tiny little miniature people engaged with everyday objects. So a piece of pasta becomes a slide, a broccoli branch becomes a tree on which these little people swing.
These
notes,
are not real people, John?
No, these are tiny little figurines.
Okay, thank you.
Computer chips become grand pianos. Cassette tapes become treadmills. A toothbrush looks like a shower. These little miniature dioramas, or is that what they're called? I don't know. That's the word that comes to mind. They're just amazing. And he does one a day. And
why is it the daily part of it interesting? Not interesting. Why?
The daily regimen of, I think they take quite a lot of time. And just the sort of daily regimen and practice. And also, when you look at them, he's been doing them for quite a while. The endless creativity with everyday objects, turning, just things you see, how you make a cracker with cheese on it look like a skating rink. The way you make an egg carton look like the mountains in Star Wars. It's amazing creativity, and the dailiness of it is something that strikes me as like, I couldn't come up with this much. And also the way your brain gets trained, if you've ever been really looking for something around the house, your like brain goes into this interesting tunnel vision in which you see all and sort all things relative to your pursuit. And so what it must be like for this guy when he looks at objects, never as what the object itself is, but at what it can be if it's thought of in this miniature, teeny, teeny, tiny little world with these little figurines. So go check it out. It's at miniature/calendar.com.
Awesome. All right, Emily the Baz.
There was an important decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit about the Texas voter ID law, which was basically a win for the plaintiffs who are challenging this law. These Fifth Circuit judges said that the law did have a discriminatory effect because so many more of the people who would likely be barred from voting or have a harder time voting would be Black and Hispanic voters. The basis for the decision is an amazing 147-page opinion by the district court judge in this case. It wasn't a total win, though. The Fifth Circuit rejected the district court's ruling that Texas, in passing this law, had a discriminatory purpose. And this is just such a difficult bar to meet, to say, legislators don't go around saying, let's keep the Black people from voting anymore. That kind of smoking gun evidence is easy to avoid and hide. And so that part of the ruling is gone. And the question, I think, is what the remedy for Texas is going to be. This was a panel of three judges. It was a Clinton appointee, a Bush II appointee, and then a district court judge appointed by Obama. So it was a pretty liberal panel. But in the end, what they were suggesting for a remedy was more widely available forms of ID. And so we'll see what the district court judge ends up adopting and what the effect and the real impact is in Texas. It does seem, though, like it's sort of heartening for lawyers who are trying to sue using Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, the part that's still left that didn't get struck down by the Supreme Court. This suggests that if you have a really strict voter ID law, that as a state, you can get in trouble under Section 2. So, it's a narrow but important victory for voting rights advocates.
All right. My chatter. I'm in the midst of consuming all sorts of just magnificent culture these days. It's really delightful. I'm finally reading. I'm the last person to read the Elena Ferrante trilogy, the Neapolitan.
Oh, so
trilogy,
good!
Which is amazing. It's fantastic. And then I'm not the last person to see the Amy Winehouse documentary. I know this because I keep urging other people to see it so I can have a conversation with them about it. You must see the Amy Winehouse documentary if you're somebody who is interested in Amy Winehouse at all. It's a fascinating movie, and she is just a absolutely gripping, complicated person. And I need to have somebody I can talk to, one, about her art, which I have very different views on now that I've seen her movie, and two, about what her fans' culpability is in her death, which a lot of the reviewers make this case that the movie suggests that we are all guilty in Amy Winehouse's death. And I really did not come away thinking that. And I just need to have I need to fight with somebody about that. So please go see the movie and then call me so that we can have a fight about it. So that would be my urging. Have either of you guys seen it? You got to see it.
No, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it. But
then we'll argue with you.
Our intern is Tark Barrett. Our producer is Mike Vuolo. Our managing producer is Joel Meyer. Joel, I think Joel also produced today's show because Mike isn't here. So I'm assuming that Joel's producing it. So thank you for that. Also.
Hey, David.
Yeah.
Actually, our freelancer, Matt Collette, is actually going to do the heavy lifting. I just do the glamorous stuff of talking to you guys.
Matt Collette?
Yeah. He's sitting here silently.
Hi, Matt.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Matt. Just leave this.
Oh, he's like,
in.
He's been sitting there silently. He's like Rob Dubbin.
All right, Matt Collette, just keep this whole thing in.
Will do. Yep. Okay.
That was Joel. Matt has remained silent.
Yeah, he's not allowed to talk yet. We're going to see how he edits and mixes the show, and then we'll let him talk.
That seems like a good policy. Seems like good.
I didn't pass that test.
I can see why Slate Podcast is the Titanic empire that it is with that silence. Don't speak unless spoken to, and even then, don't speak. Andy Bowers is the executive producer of Slate Podcast. The GabFest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at iTunes.com/Panoply, excuse me. Our show page is slate.com/GabFest. It has links to what we talked about today. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/GabFest. Our Twitter feed is @SlateGabFest, and our email address is gabfest@slate.com. You know, one thing I haven't figured out is we put up this diagram Donald Trump sentence challenge, which got a huge amount of social media retweeting and following and reading, but I don't know if anyone actually undertook the challenge. I haven't.
Yeah.
No, people
did.
Totally did.
They did.
I mean, there were two excellent entries. One was a proper. Yeah, thank you. Submission. Sorry, the lack of sleep is taking me by storm. The one was a beautiful diagramming of the sentence using all kinds of symbolism. I didn't even know it was part of that, and then the other was turning into an E.E. Cummings poem, which was far better than what we did. And I think we should find a way to publish both in.
Oh, good.
Public
Where did you
form.
Guys see that? I didn't see these.
They were sent to us at the mail. Email address.
Do you ever
you read
have
at
email?
The
Is that a thing in your life? Email.
I do.
Email obscura.
Email. All right. Okay. Well, thank you, those of you who submitted. Please subscribe to the GabFest on iTunes. Leave a comment and rating while you're there. You can search for Slate Political GabFest in the iTunes store. For Emily Bazelon, vacationing Emily Bazelon, and sleep-deprived John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We will talk to you next week and come to our San Francisco live show also.
Hi, I'm Mark Oppenheimer, the host of Unorthodox, a new podcast from Tablet Magazine. Each week, Unorthodox dissects the news of the Jews with conviction and with wit. But, you know, we're not just for Jews. We also invite in a guest non-Jew to ask us questions and even, occasionally, offer some constructive criticism of the chosen people.
Immediately off the top of my head, you guys have way too many holidays. You really do need to edit the list down.
You can listen to Unorthodox each week on iTunes.com/Panoply. Or at tabletmag.com.
Hi, This is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets. I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.